And only when I retired, I started going through an identity crisis. I kind of lost who I was. I mean, I wasn't a cop. I was a cop for 23 years, and I didn't think it was going to affect me. So I remember hearing through a buddy of mine of this treatment program only for first responders called Shatterproof, a program with FHE. My mission now is to help people and help first responders to try to get that courage, maybe give them some inspiration and hope from my story. If you would have asked me a couple of years ago, you're going, wait, you were a cop for 23 years and now you work in healthcare and you help people get help, I would have been like, but I love it. It's fun and it's very fulfilling. You know, I can establish that connection right away because, you know, I've been through some tough times.
Welcome to Respond to Resilience, along with my co-host, Dr. Stacey Raymond. I'm David Dashinger. In this episode, we'll be speaking with retired police commander and host of the number one criminal justice podcast, Patrick Fitzgibbons, about mental health, treatment, leadership, and a whole lot more. Catch all our episodes on our YouTube channel. It's Respond to Resilience. We're on Facebook, Respond to Wellness, Inc., PBSRadio.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and our website is respondertv.com. We'll be back to speak with Patrick right after this.
In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job. In this family, up to a quarter of 911 dispatchers have symptoms of PTSD. In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis while responders are quietly suffering. In this family, many struggle with job-related stress, burnout, trauma, sleep disruption, substance abuse, and marriage problems. In this family, we can help the helpers with vital information and resources, resilience strategies, and success stories of overcoming the obstacles. In this family, no one is alone. Welcome to Respond to Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacey Raymond, and Bonnie Lumley, LCSW, EMTB.
So our guest today is Patrick Fitzgibbons. He's a retired police commander from Colorado with over two decades of experience. He went through his dark periods, and he's now giving back to the first responder communities. Patrick's also a military veteran, serving with the 82nd Airborne in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. He holds advanced degrees in organizational development and leadership, and he's a part-time college professor who enjoys mentoring and coaching the next generation of criminal justice professionals. Patrick's also the host and creator of the Criminal Justice Evolution podcast. If you haven't heard it, we highly recommend it. It's got some great conversations on that. So welcome to Respond to Resilience, Patrick.
Well, thank you both, David and Stacey. I am happy to be here.
All right, so let me start by asking you the first question. Tell us a little bit about how you got involved in law enforcement.
Well, I have family members, you know, my mom's side of the family and my dad's, both sides, that were law enforcement. Now they've retired. But at the time, when I was younger, they were active duty. So I grew up with that. You know, I grew up with law enforcement and military in my family. So I naturally kind of gravitated that way because I was exposed to it, you know, growing up. And I knew that I wanted to serve in some capacity. And I just chose police work. I was in the military for a while and then kind of gravitated towards police work. And I was blessed to have a pretty good career.
So given your family of origin and your skill set, maybe your personality, how do you feel like police work was a good fit? Like what aspects of it did you really love and do you think were a good match to your personality?
Well, I grew up in a military household, David. I mean, my dad was military. He was in the Army. He was a JAG officer, which is a lawyer for people that don't know. But I grew up with that structure. You know, that structure, and a lot of people do, but it was more kind of military because he was in the military. And so, you know, I when I went into the military and I was serving, it was that structure again, that paramilitary or that military structure. And then you get into law enforcement and it's paramilitary, meaning, and you both know this, where there's rank, there's structure, there's chain of command. So I love that type of structure. And sometimes I'm like, you know, not so much anymore, but when I retired, I was like, okay, there's nobody tell me what to do, where to go, and stuff like that. I'm kind of on my own, but I love that type of structure, and that's what I was used to, and that's what kind of I gravitated to you know, when I got out of the military, I wanted that same structure. A little bit different, obviously, in mm-hmm. you know, law enforcement, but it's, you know, it's, there's orders and, you know, chain of command and all this other stuff.
So interesting. I almost feel like I came from an opposite direction where it was a lack of structure and a lack of that, you know, like knowing what to do or yeah. how to do it. And that's one of the things I loved about the fire department was that they provide the structure, the training, the instruction, and in a way the job, you know, they 911 rings and you know what you have to do. So, yeah, I guess there's an appeal yeah. to different people for different reasons.
I mean, I got, you know, I grew up and a lot of people do, or I grew up with, you know, calling, you know, my elders, sir, ma'am. I mean, I still call my best friend growing up, his parents, sir and ma'am. I don't call them by their first name, you know? I mean, so this is the way I was raised.
So, in your law enforcement career, what would you say were some of the most challenging things for you?
You know, I think, speaking for myself, it was, you know, seeing the death and the trauma. Those are always challenging. And for me, you know, it didn't really hit me. It obviously was devastating, you know, the human suffering that you see as a first responder. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it affects you, you know, when you're young, it affected me, but you know, I was able to kind of push it aside and kind of suppress it like a lot of first responders do. But as I got older, it started to affect me more, you know, where there's only so much you can put in your cup before it starts overflowing. But yeah, you know, dead kids and children and things like that, just horrible human suffering. And that, you know, first responders, not just cops, but all first responders see on a daily basis, and it starts to affect you. So to name one event, I mean, that would be, I mean, I did 23 years, so there's so many events, but it's just kind of a collaboration of human suffering and trauma. And you know, you're getting into that, you know, as a first responder. It's just that when you see it and, you know, hearing about it and seeing it are two different things. But you keep going. But eventually, I tell cops all the time and first responders, eventually it's going to affect you in some way, shape, or form, and it's going to manifest. Usually manifest in not good ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And you mentioned in your bio that there were dark points in your life. Yeah. Was that in connection with the trauma you experienced on the job?
It was. And I didn't realize it. I mean, I was irritable, you know, last couple of 5 years of my tenure as a police officer. What really was the tipping point for me, I had a family member tried to harm themselves, tried to commit suicide. And that kind of hit me, because all those incidents and all that trauma that I had suppressed for so long just came flooding back. I went through a pretty contentious divorce. My father died in 2019. So it was like a trifecta of things just hitting me all at once. And, you know, I became very depressed. I became very isolated. I had suicidal ideation. I had a plan. All the red flags that you both know are bad. And so I knew that there was a point, you know, and a lot of people don't, you know, a lot of people do, they hurt themselves, you know, it's horrible. But I knew I had two options. You know, I could kill myself, or I could, you know, reach out for help. And I chose the latter, and I reached out for help. When I had to put my fear, most importantly, my ego aside, and say, I need some help, you know, I need some help. And when I asked for help, it was like a weight lifted off my chest. And I knew I still had a lot of work to do, but it was like, finally. I remember before I went to treatment, I was just crying with my sister, and I said, they're going to take me, you know, I was sobbing, you know, and very upset and in a good way, in a happy way, you know, that I was going to get some help.
Do you think that is a common occurrence where first responders, it just, they get to the point where they are in so deep, and it's so risky at that point because they're depressed, overwhelmed, there's post-traumatic stress symptoms, and they so easily could just opt out, right? They could just take their life.
Yeah.
Would you say that is, what do you think is contributing to that, where there's just an accumulation and almost like not even realizing how big the pile is for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question, Stacey. I mean, especially today, you know, I grew up in a different time. You know, I'm a little older and grew up in a time where, say, for instance, we didn't have social media, or it was very small at the time. So now, God bless these brave men and women who go out there and serve, not just as cops, but fire, EMS, corrections, all those that have to deal with the scrutiny. And we deserve to get scrutinized. I mean, that's part of, you know, that comes with the job. But now you have, you know, social media, so young cops and even cops still on the job, veterans are seeing all this stuff going on social media. Even politicians are, you know, hopping on that. And so that, coupled with the stressors of the job, whatever you're doing in the first responder field, you know, and we all, you know, have normal stressors, you know, pay the bills, take care of the family, schedules, all that stuff, you know, all that stuff and the trauma we see. I think it's just coming at us from all angles right now. And it's very, very difficult. And like I said, and you know this, Stacey, you're a doctor. I mean, we as humans can only take so much trauma.
Sure.
You know, we can't, it's sooner or later, it's going to manifest. So for me, it was just, you know, it was hitting me all at once, like most people. And I think a lot of first responders are suffering. The majority of them are suffering. And if they're not suffering now, there's a pretty good chance they're going to be suffering later on down the road. I tell young officers and young first responders all the time, take care of yourself, not just physically, but mentally. Have outlets, have other things you do besides the job. And I was one of those cops where I lived and breathed police work. And there's nothing wrong with that, but you have to have a balance. You have to have outlets. You have to talk to people, or you should talk to people and open up to people, because you know, it's going to affect you. I don't care how big and bad you think you are. It is going to. I was one of those guys, you know. Well, you know, I came from, I was jumping out of planes in the military, all this stuff.
That personality trait, which allows you to run toward the bullets or, you know, into a burning building, unfortunately comes back to haunt you, because then it's very hard to ask for help if you're that type of very strong, you know, warrior type. You know, have a military history. A lot of cops do have a military history, or rescuer personality trait. There's then this reluctance to reach out for help yourself. And that's what I see in a lot of my first responder clients. Yeah. When they call, they are in a crisis. It's not like, oh, I thought I'd try therapy and kind of work out some of my issues. It's, you know, I can't go back to work tomorrow. Like I haven't slept in 5 days.
Yeah.
You know, I can't stop shaking. Like they're in a crisis. So.
Yeah. And I think, and you know, Stacey, I mean, you're a clinician. I mean, and you know, too, David, I mean, I think there's 40%, I think a stat I saw recently, 40% of first responders, that's fire, EMS, everybody that are suffering from addiction issues, mental health challenges, or both. And that's the number we know about. So imagine what the number it really is. It's probably much, 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 much higher. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just that we don't know, because a lot of people don't come forward. You know, and it's sad. And so my mission now is to help people and help first responders, you know, helping them to try to get that courage, maybe give them some inspiration and hope from my story and what happened to me, to have them step forward and ask for help.
What I think is amazing is that there are a number of these conversations happening on your podcast, on our show, and probably many others. There's a number of documentaries coming out where first responders are speaking their truth about what they're actually experiencing on the job. So I'm curious, Patrick, in your world, it must have taken a process to even be able to talk about this publicly, the dark periods, you know, the things you went through that took, you know, brought you to the point of needing to go for treatment. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, how it evolved to where you're now, you know, a very successful podcast host and sharing your story?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it was a little easier for me, David, because I was retired. You know, I wasn't still on the job, so I didn't have to to deal with, like a lot of first responders deal with, okay, what are people going to think of me? You know, people want to work with me. I don't trust this person. They're acting weird. I mean, all that stuff. And you both know, I mean, every organization has their different culture. We all might be cops or firemen, but every firehouse, every department has their own culture. But I was, you know, if you call it fortunate, I mean, I had retired. And only when I retired, I started going through an identity crisis. I kind of lost who I was. I mean, I wasn't a cop. I was a cop for 23 years. And I didn't think it was going to affect me the way it did. And it did. You know, I walked away from a job where, you know, I was successful and rose to the ranks. I was, you know, very fortunate to do that and work my tail off like every first responder does. But I went through that point, that crisis. And I knew that, you know, in my darkest points of what I was going through that, you know, again, I had two options. You know, I could hurt myself or reach out for help. And, you know, I remember laying on that bed with a gun and going, all right, you know, am I going to do this? And of course, I was intoxicated, which didn't help. I mean, but the moment I made that phone call, and this is just my experience, you know, the moment I made that phone call, like I said, it was like a weight lifted. You know, I could breathe a little because I was so fearful, you know, I was so fearful and I was so worried about what people are going to think, you know, Pat Fitzgibbons. I mean, I've had people tell me you always look like you had your crap together, you know, and everything was perfect. Right. Well, nobody's perfect. You know, everybody's carrying something, but I'm very transparent with it now. And I have nothing to hide. And if people are going to judge, they're going to judge. I don't care. You know, if I can help one person out there, maybe get the courage to kind of step forward and ask for help. That's what it's about for me now. You know, I mean, because so many of our brave men and women are suffering, you know, in this environment. Yeah. It's always been that way, but I think now more so than ever. We didn't have the defund stuff when I was a cop. We didn't have all this other stuff that was going, this anti-cop sentiment out there that it is so prevalent now. And so it's tough times, you know, for first responders everywhere.
It really is.
When it comes to occupational cancer exposures, members of the fire service are some of the highest risk professionals nationwide. Firefighters Against Cancer and Exposures, also known as the FACES Foundation, is an advocacy organization established to bring awareness, resources, and peer support to responders in need of additional help in battling potential cancer diagnoses or critical concerns. The FACES Foundation was established by a national alliance of first responders to offer supplemental resources for firefighters. One of its core initiatives is cancer awareness in the form of prevention and early detection, supporting vigilance about occupational cancers and cancer recurrence through our national Get Checked Now campaign. Also, the FACES Foundation publishes a major public catalog of resources for the many areas of need, including information on clinical and mental health therapies, benefits and compensations, funding sources and financial strategies. For more information, please visit the FACES website at facesusa.org.
You said you were afraid, you know, to make that phone call. And you said that it is because of what other people might think. Was there anything else to your fear?
Well, it was the fear of the unknown. You know, I was the guy that was putting people on mental health holds. You know, I mean, I was a cop, you know, it was just the fear of the unknown. I'd never been in treatment. You know, I had an idea of what it was like, but until you, you know, it's like anything else. You take that first step into the unknown. I was scared. I was terrified. Coupled with the fact that I wasn't taking good care of myself physically. I had dropped 40 pounds, you know, in 6 months. I wasn't eating. I was drinking every day. I was extremely, I had anxiety through the roof, Stacey. I never had anxiety before. I was a recluse. I stayed in the house. My day, it was like Groundhog Day. My day consisted of waking up, going to the liquor store, getting my stuff, coming back, getting hammered. Okay, it's Grubhub time. Rinse and repeat. And I remember when I left on the plane to treatment, when I finally made a call and got hooked up with FHU and Shatterproof, my sister drove me, and I was smoking heavily at the time. And I remember my sister driving me from her house in Colorado to the airport, Denver International. It was a 30-minute drive. I smoked a pack and a half of cigarettes. I was so scared.
Wow. Yeah.
And I'd never had this before. But for anybody who has never had anxiety before, an anxiety attack, and I never did up until I was in the period. It is debilitating. You know that. And I couldn't get out of the car. My sister was like, you got to get out of the car. You get out of the car. She's texting me the whole way to the gate. Did you get on the plane? Get on the plane.
Right.
And I was so afraid, you know.
Yeah.
Not just really unknown. That just contributed to it, but I was having severe anxiety.
Right. And what a scary combination to, like you said, you were a recluse, you know, to be alone, to really just on a diet of alcohol, essentially, and to have a firearm. Like that's just a lethal combination.
Oh, right there. And you know, have firearms, you know, I had all my guns, and, you know, luckily when I was, you know, when my sister took me to a hospital, that when I made that call, I was calling my sister, and she came over, and I cried and said, look, I want to hurt myself. So I went to the hospital, you know, got out of the hospital. I still needed help, but my family took all the guns. Thankfully, you know, they took all the guns. I mean, that's another thing. Good point, Stacey, especially with cops. I mean, we have the means. I mean, most of us have a ton of guns, you know, so it's, you know, you can off yourself in numerous ways, but I had the means. It was readily there.
Right.
I know in addition to doing your podcast, you're paying forward all these, you know, lessons learned and what you've been through personally. Can you talk a little bit about your work and how you're giving back to responders and what you do with FHE?
Yeah, so the Florida House Experience, otherwise known as FHE, that's the place where I went to treatment. So through my show, you know, I knew when I went to the hospital, my sister took me to the hospital, I got discharged a couple hours later and came back to the house, and I knew I needed help. And I already made the call to my sister, so they knew, the cat's out of the bag. I mean, they knew something was wrong with me. I was putting on a good mask, right? Like all first responders do. They knew something was wrong. It was just the moment I called and said I needed help to my sister. Okay, now we get it. Now it's solidified that something is going on with Patrick. But when I got back after the first hospital trip, I knew I needed help. And thankfully, I had my show. I've had my show for like 7 years and had all these contacts. And I remember hearing through a buddy of mine of this treatment program only for first responders called Shatterproof, a program with FHE, and it was down in Florida. So I'm on the phone. This time I'm motivated, right? I'm like, okay, I need some help. I was scared. I still need help. And I ended up connecting with a person that was affiliated with Shatterproof. And I went down there within 48 hours of when I made the call. And I was scared to death, like I said, but got down there. And about 2 weeks into the program, I was starting to feel better. I was starting to gain weight. I was doing great. And I said, you know what? I want to work here. I mean, I just had that in my mind. That's what I was thinking. And so when I completed my treatment, I just put it out there. I started making phone calls. I said, look, I'm retired. You know, I got some education. It's not clinical, but I mean, I have some education. I have this show. And lo and behold, you know, God works in mysterious ways. I mean, I get a call from the CEO and he says, I want you to come on board. And so now I'm in a position where I talk to first responders everywhere, mainly in the southwestern region of the United States, because I'm in Arizona, and I'm very passionate about what I do. I mean, I talk to first responders all the time and just tell them and agencies and just, you know, their peer support teams, you know, employee assistance team, whatever they call them. And I say, okay, here is a resource for your agency. And you know, I tell them about it and I say, it's a great program. Obviously it is, but that's just because I work for them, because I went through it. And you as first responders were very skeptical of everything, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And so I love giving back. You know, if you would have asked me, you know, both of you, like a couple of years ago, you're going, wait, you were a cop for 23 years and now you work in healthcare and you help people get help. I would have been like, but I love it. It's amazing. Yeah. It's fun and it's very fulfilling for me.
But who better to connect with first responders, but someone who has really been at a very low point, like suicidal, had a plan and everything, and anxiety, depression, maybe some post-traumatic stress thrown in there. Of course, they're going to listen to you more so than they're going to listen to me or Bonnie or any other clinician. Do you know what I'm saying? Because you've been there. You know what it's like to be a first responder and to ask for help and to come through it and regain your physical and your mental health. I mean, that's remarkable.
It must create some kind of trust as well to be able to speak to you as a kind of entry point.
Yeah, I mean, it helps with that because, you know, I speak the lingo and you know, like you said, I mean, I've been through it. You know, we all go through dark periods. But, you know, first responders, they're a hard group to crack. I mean, they're a hard group to, I mean, you know that, both of you, you know, to get to come forward. And there has to be a lot of trust, like most people, but specifically with first responders, there has to be a lot of trust. You know, who are you? I mean, have you done what I did? You know, I mean, that applies on the fire side and every first responder. Okay, you don't know what I've been through. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, I do. You know, I mean, I tell people sometimes, look, you're unique. You're very unique. You know, people love you. Your kids love you, whatever the situation is. But your problems aren't really unique. Mm-hmm. I mean, the problems that you are suffering from, I'm an alcoholic. Okay, that's not good, but a lot of people, you know, have struggled with addiction issues and they've come out the other side. But first responders are tough to talk to. And like you said, I have that connection or, you know, I can establish that connection right away because, you know, I've been through some tough times.
So, Patrick, you're a podcast host, very successful. You've had, I don't know, what, hundreds of episodes under your belt by this point. As a podcast host, doing this stuff with first responders, speaking to first responders, fire, police, EMS, I imagine even other types of responders, what are some of the interesting conversations that kind of stand out to you that really were special?
You know, I've been blessed, David, to have so many interviews with so many different amazing guests. But I think some of the shows that really kind of stood out to me is, you know, there was a guest on my show a couple of years ago who was don't quote me on this. I think he was a cop in Chicago in the 70s and 80s. And he got wrapped up in some illegal activities. Anyway, he was indicted, but he fled and lived in the forest for like 15 years. Down in the southern
part, that every day.
Part of the United States. And then he became very spiritual when he was living in the woods. But it was interesting, you know, to hear that story, how it was a redemption story. You know, it was finding God again. He was very religious when he grew up and kind of lost sight of God and then became religious again. So that was really memorable. And, you know, I've been blessed. Like I've had people who are incarcerated, you know, to come on the show. And I was always shocked that they were going to come on the show. And I remember, and the name escapes me again, I'm getting a little old, but a gentleman that was incarcerated for 18 years up in New York for a crime he didn't commit. It was a rape he was accused of, and it was a kind of a forced interrogation and forced confession. And he spent 18 years in prison. He became a lawyer in prison, and now he advocates for for people who are wrongly in prison. But it was amazing. And again, I thought that this, you know, having this guest on, he was going to be, you know, hate cops, but he was like, no, I actually like cops. I didn't like the cops who, you know, were interrogating me because they got me to do. And he was a young kid at that point. It happened, but I just am really, you know, blessed. You mentioned, you know, Ernie Stevens, who, you know, from Ernie and Joe Crisis Cops. He was another one that really blows me away. The work he does, I've had him on the show a couple times. The work he does, with the community when he was a cop was just amazing.
Yeah,
you know, and going out there with people in crisis, and you know, it's interesting, and you both know when I was a young cop, we just didn't. I mean, you know, mental health challenges have always been there, but you know, we just didn't deal with a lot of those calls. Now right. it's every day.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. So the cops are like, and fire too, or jack of all trades. There were, you know, many different hats. So those are just a couple. You know, I had another guest on my show who was a, you know, a cop in San Francisco, and they dubbed him like the angel of the Golden Gate Bridge because he was able to successfully negotiate like 100-something people from coming down who wanted to jump off the Golden Gate Bridge.
Wow.
You know, and commit suicide. Mm-hmm. So I've really been, you know, just blessed over the years with, and it's not me, it's just the guests, you know, that I'm able to get on the show that come on and you know, bless the show with their presence and tell their story. But I've just been amazed by the different backgrounds, mm-hmm. you know, and stories of people, you know, that have come on the show.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a service, right? Just the fact that we can witness people speaking about these things that maybe 10, 20 years ago, nobody would ever even speak out loud. And now they're coming on, you know, they're coming on shows like yours and ours and speaking about really deep, you know, personal tragedies like alcoholism, suicidality, and family problems and things like that. And they're doing it, I think, out of service, right? That's why we do the podcast, to be of service to our brothers and sisters Absolutely. Out there. And so I just feel so inspired and humbled to be witness to these people who are so generous of their personal lives.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about, you know, sharing the knowledge, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, to kind of help the next generation that are, and people who are doing it right now. Mm-hmm. But it's about, you know, that we live in an amazing time, I think, right now in terms of technology, where who would have thought that, you know, you two are, you know, a long way.
I'm in Connecticut, he's in New York, and you're
I'm in Arizona. So, I mean, who would have thought, you know, at a period, I know I wasn't thinking this way when I was a young kid. You know, we would have the ability to collaborate and talk about really some important issues that are going on out there in society, not just with first responders, but mental health affects us all. And who would have thought that we would have been doing, you know, this, you know, StreamYard call or Zoom call or whatever we're doing to spread the word. It really is amazing.
I think it's not just spreading the word and trying to affect change. I think that there's now more of a comfort level for first responders to be vulnerable. I think the key word is to, you know, you can still be strong. You can still be effective at what you do, even if you are vulnerable and transparent, Absolutely. Honest about what you've struggled with. Because the more first responders that come forth and share their stories, it gives permission to others to ask for help, just like you did, Patrick. Even though, like, you were white knuckling it as you were making that phone call, maybe you know, the more first responders that talk about their story, then other first responders that are struggling, maybe they don't have to white knuckle it. Maybe they'll say, you know, I think maybe I should go talk to somebody. It won't have to be this life or death. Do I shoot myself or you know, do I make this phone call to my sister? You know, it shouldn't be that intense. You know, it should just, maybe we have to educate more so in the academy and say, like, these, pay attention to these signs and symptoms of yourself, because there is a wear and tear effect of your job on your mental health. And when you start, if you were to start seeing these signs and symptoms, that is the time. That is the time to, you know, talk to somebody about it. So you can be a more effective police officer, firefighter, you know, paramedic, EMT, whatever the case may be. And you could be a healthier family member, maybe spouse, Absolutely. Have a better relationship with your kids. And maybe you can have some balance and enjoyment in your life. So, yeah, I mean, there's absolutely. So many benefits to, you know, that vulnerability, if you will, you know.
And I love what you said about vulnerability. You know, we as, I think, men, you know, men in particular are just conditioned, I think, from a very early age. Absolutely. Maybe not all men, a very conditioned, and I know I was. You know, not really knowing it, but, you know, I grew up in a military family and I had great parents.
Sure.
But it's like that conditioning of, okay, you don't show weakness. You don't show emotion sometimes. You just got to hold it all in.
Right.
And I don't fault my dad in particular. I mean, that's just the way he was raised.
Well, that's how he was raised too. Right.
Yeah. He was raised. So, but the point is that I tell people, look, vulnerability, and it took me a long time to get here, vulnerability is a strength.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, it's not a weakness. Right. It's not a weakness, you know. I mean, telling people that you, and I know for a lot of particularly men out there, they view that, well, if I'm vulnerable, I'm weak. You are not weak. You are strong. You can maintain your masculinity.
It takes courage to be vulnerable.
Courage, exactly. And there's nothing wrong with that. Right. You know, so, and again, I mean, everybody has their own journey on how to get there. But, you know, vulnerability is not a bad thing. Now, you don't want to be constantly vulnerable, but you want to be able to balance it out and say, no, okay, I'm suffering. I need some help, or I need to do this. I need to do that. And, you know, talking to people and opening up to people and saying, you know, I need some help. And that's a strength, because a lot of people don't do that, you know, especially first responders. You know, but it is a strength. It is not a weakness. And it took me a long time to realize that. But once I did, you know, it's like a light switch. This is okay. It's okay to be vulnerable. It's okay to be vulnerable. And as a matter of fact, some people respect that, because then they see, oh my God, this person over here, me, you, anybody, actually does have problems. And they are suffering, but you know, they had the courage to come forward say something, and maybe I can do that now.
You know, absolutely. It gives people permission.
Gives that people permission. It's like anything else. You know, one person does it, not necessarily me, but you know, somebody does something and it's a domino effect sometimes.
Yeah. I think people relate to the humanity that, you know, we're not robots, that even at first responders where we have to keep it together when people are in chaos, at some point, you know, we are human beings too. And it's so important to be able to, you know, let it out, like to, you know, to do a healthy gut check. And if you need to cry, cry. If you need to, you know, scream, scream, or whatever that is. And I think that's where therapy can be helpful, when if you recognize that you need it, hopefully that's sooner rather than later. That leads me to a question related to this, Patrick. And I know you were a leader in the police department. What are your thoughts about how leadership can help encourage breaking the stigma around mental health and supporting their members who may be struggling and maybe recognizing that they need the help?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a culture thing. And I tell people, or advise people all the time, look, it doesn't matter if you work for LAPD, Chicago PD, Denver PD, wherever. I think first and foremost, those leaders in the organizations have to get to know their people better. Because when you know your people better, you can see signs. You know, you got this high producer over here, meaning people, you know, they're going out there, they're a hard charger, and then all of a sudden they dip. You know, we all seen it. You saw it in the fire service. You see it, Stacey, where, you know, there's changes. So something's going on. I mean, it's just fostering that environment of, look, we are going to support you. And unfortunately, it's not as prevalent as we're talking about. I mean, I think a lot of organizations still struggle with this, where a lot of organizations are just talking the talk, you know, but they're not walking the walk. It's kind of that old school mentality. But, you know, I think, getting to know people, you know, I mean, I used to, you know, pull people in and just talk with them. Am I in trouble? No, you're not in trouble. Let's just BS. You know, how you doing? Now, it took me a while to get there, but, you know, I missed some, you know, personnel stuff that was going on because I was so wrapped up, and I had to, you know, okay, I need to start, you know, getting to know my troops better. So it's not rocket science. It's not complex. It's just kind of fostering that environment. But, you know, a lot of it comes from the top down. So, you know, I mean, young cops, young troops, whatever you want to call them, you know, they're looking at what the leaders of the organization are doing. So if you're not fostering that environment, you know, if you're not, I'm not saying you don't go out there and you do cop stuff or fire stuff, but if that's not felt within an organization, you talk to any cop out there or fire, and what's majority of them say? Well, we don't feel supported. We don't feel supported by our command staff. Okay. Why is that? You know, why is that? So those command level officers and those leaders and organizations, they need to take that and say, now, I'm not saying, okay, some of it's disciplinary, you know, and people are just, you know, they're going to be the way they are with disciplinary stuff. But if the overall air of the environment is, you know, they don't, people don't feel like they can open up, that's a serious problem.
It is.
Absolutely. You know, doesn't that also
problem with an organization?
Doesn't it also help when you're developing leaders, you know, when they're in the rank and file, that they see that their supervisors are taking an interest in their well-being, that when these people become eligible to promote and do promote, that they can now say, you know what, I see this, this was a model for me, how I can supervise and be a better, more effective, compassionate leader.
And especially now more than ever, you both know what, people aren't flocking to the first responder field anymore. I mean, you know, I mean, people don't want to become cops. Thank God that men and women are still doing it in fire, but not in the droves that I remember when I first got into it. And so the point in that is our most important thing we have is our human capital, is our is our people that work for us. And we need to take care of them better than we are. A lot of organizations, that, and that includes knowing your troops better, setting up those programs where they can do it anonymously. If they want to, I mean, because nobody wants to go into a commander's office or a sergeant's office and start
to load. That's so, where the peer support team,
the peer support team
is there for that. So
but you know, it's fostering that environment, Stacey. You know that. I mean, fostering that environment. Again, nothing's going to be perfect, but at least having that feeling of okay, I can go to my staff, I can go to my sergeant, I can go to my corporal, whatever the chain of command is in the organization, and the, you know, fire service, same thing. And, you know, David, I need some help. Can you recommend anything for me? And this is what's going on, you know, and being able to say, all right, yeah, I you know, Pat, we're going to get you some help, instead of just suck it up and go back to work, which unfortunately is still prevalent in a lot of organizations.
Yes.
Right.
You know? And in knowing, you know, what resources are available.
Yeah. And I, you know, and I tell people all the time, David, and Stacey too, and the listeners, is don't rely on your organization to, you know, take care of everything for you. Yeah, they're responsible for training you and getting the hours in and all that stuff. But we, there's so much information out there. You got to vet it, you know, make sure it's reliable and good information.
Right.
But there's so much information out there, you know, that, that you can do, and you can self-initiate, and you can say, look, David, you're a lieutenant. I'm a young firefighter. I found this program that I think might help me. What do you think? You know, David has... And you know this, David, you have, okay, you're a lieutenant, you're at that command level, you have all these people that you got to manage. So yeah, I need to take care of my troops, but you can also do things and self-initiate stuff on your own.
Yeah. That I think it's part of your tool, your leadership toolkit.
Yeah, exactly.
What we're talking about is as important as, you know, knowing who to call when you have a problem.
Absolutely. With
animal control or building department or highway department. Yeah, we should all have a notebook that's got, you know, a whole set
of resources.
Yeah.
Resources for everything. Or this is who I call, or I get pointed in this direction if I'm struggling financially or you know, with alcoholism or whatever. I like that idea. That's great. So that's another thing that agencies can do at a relatively, you know, low cost, probably.
Right.
You know, because everybody's stretched for dollars.
I know this is happening in some police departments, probably fire departments too. But, you know, on the police website, you know, there's going to be only, you can have access if you're, you know, a member of that police department, and you can do a private search of resources available.
Absolutely.
If you're having marital issues, there's some vetted, you know, couples counselors, they accept this insurance or they, you know, this is their fee or whatever. And I can click on that and nobody needs to know that I'm having, you know, marital issues or whatever, but at least this is what my my peers have recommended as, you know, a person who understands a police culture, fire culture, you know, and how that can impact a marriage.
Yeah.
There should also be, you know, financial information, a chaplaincy, you know, a list of chaplains on there. You know, all sorts of resources so that if there's, you know, if they don't want to ask, you know, their, you know, their sergeant or lieutenant, whatever the case may be, for, you know, where, what, can you point me in the right direction? It's right there. And maybe every department had, you know, their own, you know, access on their website, you know, where members could find that information. I think it takes the reluctance out of the issue.
Right. Well, there's still reluctance there, but I mean, it makes it easier for some.
Yeah, that's what I meant. It's
to take it a step further.
Makes it easier. Oh, go ahead, Dave.
To take it a step further, technologically, there's apps for that now that are specifically tailored to police or fire and to the particular agency. And it works in a way that it de-identifies who's using it. So if a cop wants to check on, you know, substance abuse counselors or rehab facilities or contact somebody for marriage counseling, all these resources are in there, very well organized. And it can be, like I said, customized to the department, but the people using it don't have to worry that they're being tracked or they're going to be identified for needing the resource.
You know, and an organization can have all the apps and the tools and resources at their disposal. But again, I think it really, in my opinion, it comes back to the culture of that organization, you know, and the environment of that organization. Every organization is going to ebb and flow. But if the overall environment of that organization is, you know, I feel afraid or I don't want to, because it's in the air. It's palpable. You know what I mean? I mean, people don't want to talk about anything. I think that there, it doesn't matter what apps you have. It doesn't matter what resources you have. I think, I mean, it helps, obviously. It makes it a little easier. But if the air and the culture of an organization is one where we just suck it up and we don't talk about it, I think that's the bigger challenge, in my opinion. And I'm not saying everything's perfect and everything's rosy all the time and stuff like that. I get it. But there has to be a culture shift or an environmental shift. I'm talking about just the mood of an organization. And that starts with command staff, and that starts with leadership. And some organizations are better at it. Right. And some aren't, quite frankly. And, you know, I was speaking to an organization here in you know, in Arizona. It was that same thing. They had a bunch of resources in place, but it was still, you know, it was still command staff leadership, mid-level leadership that still fostered that suck it up attitude. You know, so, I mean, that's, you know, it's kind of, it's one of those things where, you know, there's so many things going on in the first responder community, but I really think we need to take a look, some organizations, at the culture we're fostering and who are in those leadership roles. I'm not saying firing. I'm just saying, okay, are they really representing? Are they really, are we really kind of talking about what we're, you know, in the action, you know, backing up what we're saying and all those things. It comes down to like the field training officers. I mean, are we going to have people in there that everything sucks or, you know, life sucks, department sucks, chief sucks, everybody sucks in those critical roles where they're training new officers? Or are we going to have people that are generally happy to be there training our new officers? So there's just like an onion. It's like pulling back these, in my opinion, is pulling back these layers. And but we're getting there. I think we're getting a lot better. It's definitely a lot better than when I started, and David, you probably started in fire. I mean, it's much more, we have a lot more awareness on it, but I still, we think we have a long way to go.
Definitely. Well, Patrick, we could probably speak to you probably another hour or so, but, we'll have to come back to this another time.
Absolutely.
In the meantime, where can people find you out there on internet and social media?
Well, they can find all my links, and I appreciate for mentioning that, David. They can find everything about me at cjevolution.com. And again, I just want to say really quick, if anybody's suffering out there, I do work for FHE Health and their Shatterproof program for first responders. It's specifically designed for first responders. It's run by a lot of first responders. It's for first responders only, located down in Deerfield Beach, Florida. You can call me. It's all confidential. You know, I don't do anything with the information except if you want to seek treatment, I pass that along to my team. It's all confidential, and you can reach me at 303-960-9819.
Perfect. We'll put your links up there as well.
Thank you, sir.
Patrick, it has been an absolute pleasure to speak to you.
Thank you both.
Kudos for the amazing podcast you've created and all the work you're doing out there with FHE.
I appreciate it. Thank you both so much. God bless.
It was a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks.
I appreciate it.
So remember to like and subscribe. We're on YouTube, Responder Resilience, Facebook, Responder Wellness, Inc., bbsradio.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and our website is respondertv.com. Till the next time, stay safe, be kind to yourself, take care.